Live from Burbank, California, where the city council is planning to bomb Iran, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he only leaks for the good of the American people. Mark Maron.
Oh, thank you, Jim. That was lovely. That really was. How are you, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course, you lurking conservatives, welcome aboard to the show. Man, I was in New Orleans, Jim. I'm going to talk to you about that in just a second, but let me tell the lovely people of America who is on our program this evening. We have Chastity Bono on our show. She, of course, is the daughter of Sonny. That's what I meant to say. Sonny and Cher. She is the daughter of Sonny and Cher. And I remember, you're older than me, obviously.
Yeah, but not that older.
You're older than me, obviously. And you can say whatever you want, but you're older than me.
Not that old.
No, you're an older man, I think, a bit. Older man than I am.
More mature.
Yeah, whatever. All right. Yeah, fine, if that's the way you want to do it. But I remember her when she was a little girl. I'm going to talk to her about the fact that, like, she cares. It's so weird. We get guests into this... onto the program, and I think they're going to be interested in my experiences with them. Like, as opposed to most interviewers who would just go ahead and interview them, I want to tell her that Sonny and Cher was actually the first concert I ever saw as a human.
Really?
Yes. My parents took me to see Sonny and Cher at the Pit in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they were about this big. They're about as big as a little pinch. Like, we were way up at the top. I think, if my recollection serves me, we were about two seats down from the very top of a basketball arena. So Sonny and Cher, it was just like a haircut and a mustache and a thin woman with long hair. And that was about all I saw.
Who opened for them? Hendrix?
What do you want from me? I have no idea. But the second concert I saw with my parents was Peter Frampton. And he also was about that big. My father just had no connections with getting tickets, apparently. And I remember there was one concert, if I can digress just a bit,
where
my father was trying to bond with me, trying to connect a little bit, trying to do, like, how can I reach out to my wayward teenage son who's growing pot in the front yard? And he actually said, I had very liberal parents, liberal to a fault in the sense that they didn't tell me not to do anything. And they just assumed that I was growing pot, that didn't mean I would smoke it. But during this one particular concert, I believe it was Frampton, my father says, so you got any of that pot you grow? And I sat there and smoked a joint with my father. And my mother kept saying, Barry, what are you doing? Barry, because that's his name. It would have been weird if it wasn't his name, but it was, fortunately. So that worked out.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't remember getting high or what, but I do remember it was uncomfortable, and I remember that I felt guilty for getting my father stoned.
What do you think the statute of limitations is on that crime that happened between your parents and that underage kid?
Look, if you want to arrest my father, it would help him out. It would give him something to do. It would give him a place to live that had discipline and focus. He wouldn't be so miserable. So we have Chastity Bono in just a few minutes. We have Stephen Elliott, who is the executive director of LitPAC. He's an author of a political memoir called Looking Forward to It, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the American Electoral Process. That I want to know how. I want to know how he stopped worrying, because I need to stop worrying. But LitPAC is a political action committee that is a collective of writers who are trying to raise awareness politically and also do a lot of fundraising, and they get behind progressive candidates. He's going to tell us who and why. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to this guy, Brian Nelson. He's a writer of the new film Hard Candy. He's also the producer of the film. And this is a scary movie, dude. This is about a predator, an internet predator who cajoles or seduces or predatorizes. What do you say? Where he gets a 14-year-old girl to come to his house.
Preterates.
Of course, that's the word. It was preterates. I knew I was looking for the word. But he's going to be on. This movie is very graphic and very disturbing. But before we get off on a bunch of different topics here, a lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure that you don't get caught off guard or uninformed. So here now is tonight's edition of Mark Maron's show's Short Order News. Computer drives containing U.S. military secrets are being stolen from an American base in Afghanistan and sold by thieves at a nearby bazaar. Apparently, the flash drives are being swiped by Afghani cleaners, garbage collectors, and other workers from the base. At least the Bush administration may have found a new way to leak information. A screaming bearded man was arrested on White House grounds while the president was at home. Understanding that the bearded man is mentally ill, Secret Service men gently removed him to a facility where he could get the appropriate care. A naked pyramid where dogs could bark at his genitals. Just like the Wallace and Gromit film, a monster rabbit has apparently been rampaging through vegetable patches in a small village in northern England and infuriating local gardeners. The monster rabbit is described as having big floppy ears and horrible teeth. Oh, I'm sorry. That's actually a description of Prince Charles. Prince Charles.
Fluffy ears.
Prince Charles.
Big, horrible teeth.
And that's Mark Maron's show, Short Order News, for tonight. Prince Charles. You know, sometimes if you hit the punchline a few times, it resonates a little more. So you want to hear about New Orleans?
Yeah, yeah.
I was, I got to be honest with you. I took the gig because you don't, I am in a program of advice, I'm going to call it, where if you are asked to do service, then you should not turn down the opportunity to do service of any kind, because doing service and being altruistic or charitable, it makes you a better person whether you like it or not, because it makes you think about something other than you, which I need as much as possible. So I agreed to do this benefit. Now, here's the catch. I get there. I get to New Orleans. And usually I'm a lot more prepared than I was for this. I didn't know who my contact was, but the guy called me, Bill. He's a comic. He was a great host and a great guy. Wild Bill Dykes, they call him. And to be on the show with me was supposed to be Brian Callen. Do you know Brian Callen?
No,
he was on Mad TV. Well, I get to the show, and Brian Callen missed his plane. So it's just me. No problem. I'm just a little nervous about New Orleans, about what I've heard about New Orleans, about what it's really like. And we get to the hotel. We get to the area where I'm going to be hanging out, and everything seems pretty normal. There's not a lot of people around, but in terms of damage and the attitudes of people, given that it's 7 months after Katrina, things seem okay. And we do the show. We had a lovely turnout. We had about 160 people in this rock club. There was a local showcase. A lot of comics from the area went on. And then I headlined after Bill went on and this guy Tom. And it went great. Everybody was very appreciative. We did it for the United Way. And the next day, Bill takes me around the areas in New Orleans that were hit by Katrina. Now, you can't even fathom. Like, I it's not that I had put it out of my mind, but even if you saw flood footage on the TV, even if you saw the neighborhoods that were being discussed, the Ninth Ward and also the Lakeside or Lakeview District in New Orleans, if you saw them on TV, even if I had a camera with me, there would be no way to capture just the scope of the damage, man. I mean, we took a ride around. This was not a poor neighborhood, the Lakeview or the Lakeside neighborhood. This is where the it wasn't the breach of the levee, but it was the swell of Lake Pontchartrain came over into this neighborhood. And man, the water line on these houses was about 7 feet up, and all the water is gone. But there are miles and miles and miles, blocks upon blocks upon blocks of abandoned, useless homes now. Windows broken, nothing on the street, no electricity, just complete ghost lands. But for square miles. It was devastating. I could never have imagined just how bad it was. And then we went into the Ninth Ward, which was the rundown sort of ghetto area. But that place, completely devastated. None of the businesses are open. About 90% of the population, not 90, but like 80% hasn't returned. So what you're dealing with is you have the French Quarter and some of the other neighborhoods that weren't affected downtown, where life is going on as normal, kind of, but it's they're calling it the Isle of Denial, the people that live in those areas or work in those areas, because they've had to detach from the fact that there's more than half of the city is no longer there. So there's definitely all kinds of frenetic activity and a lot of partying going on in the French Quarter. But there is that same sense. You were in New York. Were you in New York after 9/11?
Yeah, yeah.
You know that numbness, that shock, that even though you weren't at ground zero, I mean, granted it was different, that, you know, it was a terrorist attack and it was incredibly frightening and you smelled that horrendous smell for months and months coming out of ground zero. But you have that same sort of persistence where, you know, we have to continue our lives even though we know that we are surrounded by this horrendous damage. There's no forecast as to when it's going to be fixed or how it can be fixed. I don't even know how. And then beyond the negligence that caused it to occur, that place is... it is screwed for a very long time. And all I can say is that I would really encourage people to visit New Orleans and to, you know, take in, you know, what New Orleans has to offer, because if they don't get some income coming into that city soon, as if the economy hasn't fallen out already, it's going to get worse, because the people there are ready to be hospitable. They're ready to entertain. They're ready to have the tourist industry reopen. As far as redeveloping, there's a big cluster, you know, whatever going on in terms of people grabbing up lands. I don't know what role eminent domain is going to play in the poorer neighborhoods or how that's all going to pan out, but it is a complete and utter disaster still. And there is still up to 80% of the population not there. And right now there's 22 candidates challenging Ray or May Nagin for his seat. And apparently people are doing everything they can to vote in those primaries. A lot of people are returning to vote in the primaries. So, but please, do whatever you can to support New Orleans and go there, because the people want you to come, and it is still New Orleans. Look, folks, in just a few seconds, we've got Chastity Bono coming out. You know what? Give it a couple minutes. How's that? Just after this, Chastity Bono will be here. And later in the show, Stephen Elliott from LitPack. Stay with us.
And now he's more accurate than Wikipedia, Mark Maron.
Oh, man, I wish I was more accurate than Wikipedia. Thanks, man. That's a compliment. Thanks, Jim.
Well, you're very accurate in saying that you weren't accurate.
I'm just being honest with my insecurity. Thanks for bringing that out. I appreciate it. It's always good when your co-host brings out the insecurity.
No problem.
No, I appreciate it, man. It's good to have you here. I was just about feeling good about myself. I forgot to mention the food in New Orleans, and I think I'm going to tease that. I'm going to do a deep tease. Later in the show, I'm going to tell you what I ate. But first, right now, this is strange to me, because I remember Chastity Bono from when I was like a little kid watching the Sonny and Cher show. I imagine a lot of people do. As most of you know, she is the daughter of Sonny and Cher. She's been an actress, a musician. But in the last few years, she's risen to some incredible challenges in her own life and taken on the role of activist. And she's here with us. Thanks for coming, Chastity.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you're here. And I was just telling Jim that you're probably not going to care, really. But the first concert I ever saw was your parents.
That's cool.
My parents said, "We're going to see Sonny and Cher." And I saw them. And did you ever travel with them on the road? Did they ever bring you?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How old, like, when you started?
Birth.
You were traveling with them?
Yeah,
You're probably backstage.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. No, I don't. I mean, I don't remember it that young, but yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any memory of traveling with them at all? Yeah. Not really.
Not very, very little.
Do you get
very little?
Yeah. Do you get along with your mom now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's cool. I just find it fascinating when I meet somebody that was so much part of the cultural consciousness for like at so young a time. That I imagine that a lot of people still come up to you with that stuff. Like,
oh, yeah. It's bizarre to have been such a part of kind of pop culture at that time and. But I don't remember it, so it's really weird.
It's probably
weird to be part of like this big thing, and yet you have no memory, and everybody else has this kind of feeling that they've attached to it.
That they knew you.
Yeah.
And it's funny that few people are in the position where, like, if they do have a sort of blackout in their memory from when they were young, you can actually go to the Museum of Television Broadcasting and watch part of your history.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess what happened. You've been involved with the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Now, how did that first start?
The organization?
Yeah,
your
involvement with it.
I was their entertainment media director when did I go there? I was there in 97 and 98.
And what was this sort of series of events that brought you to political awareness? Because I remember you were outed, and then initially you didn't accept it, and then later you embraced it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was outed, and I wasn't ready to come out at that point. And
that must be horrible.
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough.
And did you get angry at the guy or the woman who did it? Do you know who did it and how it happened?
You know, I mean, I don't know who leaked it.
Yeah.
I don't. You know, it was the Star magazine. They kept, you know, running issues and issues and issues about it because it was a big seller.
Yeah.
I mean, angry. Yeah, of course I was angry because it's just an intrusion, and then you've got people following you, and you know the tabloids can be rough.
In that situation, was there pressure? Because in my recollection of other people who've been in that situation, did you get pressure from gay and lesbian groups to own it and stand up?
Yeah, at that time, this is in 1990 that I got outed, and. So in that time in the community, there was kind of a fringe movement of the community outing people.
Mm-hmm.
It was really before anybody had come out on their own. So, yeah, there was definitely some pressure. There was a magazine at that time called Outweek,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they were putting a lot of pressure to try to get me to come out. But
that's weird that a community that is protective of their boundaries in a certain degree would actually push people to do that.
Well, again, you know, this was a long time ago, mm-hmm. and this was, you know, way before you know, everything kind of shift with Clinton. So, mm-hmm. you know, you're back in the era where AIDS is still really prevalent, mm-hmm. and you know, the Reagan-Bush administration hadn't been, you know, dealing with it, talking about it, anything. And
right.
so the political climate in the gay community then was very different. It was very reactive and very angry, and, you know, it shifted significantly later on when Clinton got into office and really when I became politically active, it was just a different time. Things changed a lot very mm-hmm. quickly, and things changed a lot when people started coming out too in the early 90s, you know, Katie Lang and Melissa Etheridge, and, you know, that kind of started to open the floodgates for things to change.
And in the book that you wrote, Family Outing, was mm-hmm. that what came out of that experience for you, that book?
Well, yeah, I ended up, I mean, the first thing that I got involved in after I came out on the cover of The Advocate and started writing for them, and then I ended up getting hooked up with the Human Rights Campaign and worked for them for a year and, you know, traveled all around the country for them as their national coming out spokesperson. But mm-hmm. it was 96, it was election year, so doing a lot of campaigning. And, yeah, I think that I, at that point, started to really understand the significance of coming out, both on a personal level, but also the political, you know, significance and ramifications of that. And, you know, wanted to write a book to try to help people out with that.
Well, I'd like to, in just a second, we're gonna take a quick break and we're gonna come back. I'd like to talk obviously about what you're doing now, but also just a little bit of reach out in terms of people who might be dealing with that in their families.
Sure.
Can you do that?
Yeah.
All right, we're talking to Chastity Bono. We will continue talking to her in just a couple minutes. So stay with us. You're listening to the Mark Maron Show.
Now back to a man who's gruff, but lovable. Mark Maron.
I think you misrepresent me to everybody, Jim, but am I gruff?
Okay, you're not lovable.
Okay.
You're gruff.
I think I'm reading into your intros too much. I should probably just let you do them and not respond to everyone as if it's an attack on me.
Yeah, because, you know, I just make these things up out of the blue. They mean nothing to me.
Right, you don't put any work into it at all. You're just sort of like, how do I fill this time?
Right.
All right, well, I'm going to talk to our guest now. We're talking to Chastity Bono. We're talking right now about the book Family Outing and about, you know, outing in general, and about, you know, because there still is obviously a very powerful and evil faction in this country, socially and governmentally, that still completely represses gay rights. It's still completely – they actually believe that you can, with religion – stop people
right.
from being gay.
Yeah.
And I imagine that – even though the culture has changed and the gay community has become grounded and resourceful and empowered, that there's still plenty of people in small towns that just can't get out, can't come out, and can't feel comfortable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think definitely. And again, you know, now with the political climate is just so anti-gay that I'm sure it's probably a lot harder in certain places than it was you know, 5-10 years ago.
Oh yeah, I can't even imagine how regionalized everything's become, even around the reproductive freedom debate.
Yeah.
And just by virtue of the fact that it's going to become nearly impossible to get an abortion in some states or to get proper health care as a woman, that they're just not afraid to deny people human rights. And they're not AIDS education is down again. This guy has actually moved us back in time.
Oh, I mean, so significantly, it's kind of frightening. You know, I mean, I haven't been that politically active in the gay community for a while now since Bush has been in office and
why so? Would you just get tired of him or something? You're like, all right,
No, I think my addiction problem got out of hand and kind of took me out of commission from everything, and then getting clean and sober has allowed me to kind of, you know, now have the courage to focus on some of the things that are a little bit, you know, not more selfish, but some of the dreams that I've had and things that I've wanted to do for a long time. And I think if anything, I've just broadened what interests me politically because it's, you know, things are so bad that it's really hard to just focus on gay issues for me right now, because it's so bad across the board for everybody that, I think it's kind of better just to try to focus on getting the Democrats back in control. And then, then at that point you can start to deal with the other issues that we were fighting, you know, before Bush took over.
Sure. As somebody who has been submerged in addiction myself and been sober for a few years myself, it's amazing just how – it's not amazing. It's completely understandable just how much it derails you and how self-absorbed and how, you know, just the addiction – just not just getting clean, but being an addict is such a self-contained little world. And all you think about is like, how can I get my stuff?
That's you know, I mean, at the end, that's all it comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, the best thing for me still about getting clean and sober is the fact that I'm no longer a slave to a substance and that I can think about something other than my next fix.
Yeah.
Oh,
all of a sudden you got all this free time and you're like, oh man, I'm having feelings. Could someone help me out with these? What do you do with this? Why am I crying right now?
Yeah.
Why do I want to rip that guy's head off? Yeah. And it takes a while for everything to level off, but I'll tell you, the once you get your emotions in line, the availability of your heart becomes so much broader, and you can really do what you want to do. I've been munching on nicotine gum. I got myself all re-addicted on nicotine and like going nuts.
Yeah, that's the one I can't give up. That's been a really hard one. I switched, you know, to the natural additive-free tobacco, and that's kind of
the
where I've
tobacco.
Gotten stuck. Yeah, the healthier alternative, I guess.
Oh, I don't know. I saw you on that. You did that show where – what was that show you did?
Oh,
where
Celebrity Fit Club.
Celebrity Fit Club,
yeah. Jim's a big fan of those shows. But I was,
oh, man, I watched the whole thing, yeah.
How much did you end up losing on that show?
I lost 25 pounds.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great. It was fun.
Did you actually do it because you like, well, this is a good excuse to get in shape? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly. I did it because somebody was going to pay me to lose weight and get in shape. So, you know.
Oh, I'd like somebody to do that for me. Could somebody pay me to go to the gym more frequently?
Yeah. You know, there's no pressure that you can put on yourself like being on national TV and being berated by a drill sergeant to make you lose weight. It really works.
Yeah, there's something about public humiliation.
Humiliation, really.
That's pretty effective.
You know, and then you've got your team members, and you're trying to win, and they're all counting on you. And so the pressure was insane, but it worked.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Did you did you make any, you know, like lifelong friends with your team?
I did, actually. It always cracks people up, but Tempest Bledsoe and I've become really, really good friends
because
everybody like hated her on the show. It just didn't represent her well. But yeah, we're very tight.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, I want
your target weight loss goal this week will be.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now? What's coming up for you?
What am I working on? I've got a script in development that I wrote at one of the gay cable networks here, TV, and just starting to work on some projects for myself, a TV project that I want to do, and and
just pitching the ideas
pitching the ideas and getting stuff down and
going into those offices where people go, we love you.
Yeah.
Oh, we're so happy you're here.
Exactly.
And then it's like, how's that project going? And they never call.
Yeah, they never. Yeah, of course. So, yeah, it's a, I mean, it's a grind, but, you know, I finally got my stuff together enough to be able to do it. So that's good.
Well, that's great. Congratulations on that. Now, can I just ask you about the End of Innocence? Because I'm not familiar with the book. And that's about your experience in music.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of the backdrop. It's about a relationship that I had with a woman who ended up dying of cancer.
No, I'm sorry.
And it kind of happened while I was in the record industry. So it's got a nice behind the scenes look at the record industry, which I didn't really like. So it's not a very kind one, but I think it's entertaining.
It's an incredibly lucrative industry filled with vipers and demons and evil,
just the worst,
exploitive people. I mean, your dad was like, I had no idea up until a couple of years ago how long he had been in music before he even became Sonny and Cher. I mean, he used to be in the Phil Spector's Music Factory, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Wow, did you never knew Phil Spector when you were a kid, did you?
You know, not that I remember, but I'm sure I probably had been around him. I don't know. I mean, you know, when they, my dad was like his you know, assistant, his kind of right-hand guy, and then him and my mom would do all the background vocals for his stuff. So, you know, on some of those old, you know, records
like the Ronettes,
and stuff. You can hear my mom and dad doing the background vocals.
That's wild.
Yeah, it is. So that's, you know, that's how they got started.
So what's your mom doing? Do you talk to her frequently? Or?
Yeah, she's you know, she just got off of like a 3-year long tour. So
that's unbelievable.
She's kind of just chilling right now, which is good.
Because you're such an earthy kind of, you know,
right,
grounded, you know, regular person. The Cher is this other thing to me. Like, she is like this, like, I don't know what you would call her, but she's bigger than life.
Yeah,
is she like that around the house?
No, not at all. No. I mean, I think that person, that Cher, is another thing to me also.
Oh, really?
It probably has to be to her to a degree, too. I mean, it's really hard to merge those that larger-than-life kind of living icon status and then, you know, you're just a regular person, too.
Yeah, so you don't go over to her house and go, why are you wearing all of that?
Yeah, no, it's sweats around the house and, you know, it's.
Do you have a relationship with, like, your half-brothers? Like, what's your half-brother, the Almond kid?
Oh, Elijah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And there's another one, too, right?
And then there's the young ones, Cesare and Chiana from my dad.
Okay.
So
that's amazing. And so you see Greg Allman occasionally too?
No. Never. Never. I don't think my brother gets to see him much, but
oh, really?
You know, a little bit. I know that they actually have started kind of talking a little bit, but Greg was never really the parental type. So
right.
You know, but he's got the same disease, so it's hard to cast stones at him. He's just trying to get by. But yeah, no, I haven't seen. I can't even remember the last time I saw Greg.
That's an amazing thing about recovering from addiction is how much it sort of stifles your ability to judge people negatively.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? You're sort of like, I understand why that guy's an evil bastard.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a bad guy. He's just an alcoholic and an addict for like his entire life.
Right.
So, it just makes me grateful that, you know, at 35 I was be able to I stopped it.
Yeah, I know.
So
that's the other thing too, is that just as outside of the disease itself, you realize as you get older, it's like, God, this is exhausting.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I just don't have the energy to do this anymore.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming down, Chastity. Is there anything else you wanted to get in before?
No,
you're good?
Cool. Yeah, I'm great.
Thank you. Great talking to you,
and
good luck with all your projects
and
sobriety. We'll be back in just a minute, but I think we're going to do the War on Brains. Would that be okay? You think
sure.
We could get, what is it, Milvington or Mortensen? Or?
Yeah, whatever.
All right, Jim. All right, stay with us. Mark Maron Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now he's patient zero for infectious laughter. Oh, man.
Oh.
Mark Maron.
Man, you're cracking yourself up.
Oh, man, that was just sickening.
Hilarious.
That was absolutely sickening.
It was wrong. I just can't believe I'm talking to Chastity Bono, and I for some reason, was saying that Cher was this. She is bigger than life.
She's your idol.
Well, no, because that was...
You've modeled your life after Cher.
I have a gay man inside of me that wants to get out. Yeah, I mean, not like that. Don't go that. No.
You just painted a wonderful picture.
Well, I mean, I want people to know what we do out here in Hollywood. You know what I mean? You just got to live on the edge. We got a kid in the studio,
yeah.
And you're already going in that direction.
Man, you just violated the RICO law.
Bill Kohar's son, Zach, here. Sweepy Bill Kohar. Son, Zach, is in town. He came out just to party, apparently. How old are you, 12? 12? How old is he, 12? Yeah, 12? Wow, man. When I was 12... I'll tell you, I was already driving, and my parents had bought me a small plane that I would fly around the world, party with people in Paris. I partied with Rimbaud and Baudrillard and all the people. Some of them are dead. That's how amazing that plane was. Anyways, I don't do what I do. Every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the six-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Atlanta, Georgia, home of the world's largest collection of charmingly restored slave auction houses. The War on Brains continues, you lumpin' ineffectuous, with your Lou Dobbs comb-overs. For while this nation of slack-jawed monkeys sat transfixed by the battle of wits between Ryan Seacrest and Simon Cowell, the forces of stupid came from behind, did a reach around, and grabbed you by your withered First Amendment. Last week, Georgia, the state, not that fat maid on Maud.
That's Florida, I think.
What?
The fat maid on Maud was named Florida, not Georgia.
Well, thanks for clearing that up, Captain Joke Kill. Anyway, Georgia is about to become the first state to use the Bible as a textbook in public schools. It's the most heinous violation of separation of church and state since 1850, when the Louisiana school system bought 100 volumes of McGuffey's popular reader entitled J is for Christ-Killing Jew. Shameful. Ignominious. A newly signed Senate bill would create two courses, Mark. One called History and Literature of the Old Testament, and then the informative God may have condoned murder, incest, and animal rape, but he was under a lot of pressure. The governor says, yes, that's right.
Uh-huh.
The governor says materials other than the Bible will also be allowed. But unfortunately, those materials don't include brain matter. Brain matter.
Hey, brain matter.
Tommy Williams. There's the music again.
Hey, thank God it came back. I didn't know what to do.
Makes it much funnier.
Yeah.
Tommy Williams, the Georgia State Senate Majority Leader who sponsored the bill, said the law was intended to encourage kids to understand the Bible's many cultural influences. Mm-hmm. For only by understanding these cultures can we better learn how to put them in camps and make them clean up after us. Williams complained, quote, kids are illiterate of the Bible, which in and of itself is illiterate.
You want to do that line again?
Sure.
Let's try it. Let's just go back, because I think he said illiterate.
Yeah. Williams complained, quote, kids are illiterate of the Bible, which in and of itself is illiterate. What he should have said was this, kids are ignorant of the Bible. I'm illiterate of the Constitution. Well, that doesn't matter much to Tommy Williams, whose greatest accomplishment until now was supporting a law allowing every hayseed in Georgia to drive with a gun. But the long spectacle of moronitude will not end there, Mark.
Yeah.
Because Alabama, the state, not that crappy country rock band, is also considering them similar measures. What choice does this give the rest of the country? Simple. We have to finish fighting the Civil War. Sherman's biggest mistake on his way to the sea was not torching Atlanta's churches. For as long as Georgia, the state, not Florida, the fat maid in Maud... Man, see, that just isn't as funny. As long as Georgia and the other states like it, ignore the fact that God is either drunk, dead, or asleep on a vinyl couch, the rest of us will have to endure a whole generation of children brought up on Funyuns and the worst book ever written. And I'm not talking about he's just not that into you. Although I could be... And that's today's dispatch from
Wow.
Sammy the Sim Cell.
Man, this is a smooth transition into the new studios. You know, that's what's great about radio. It's not unlike garage rock. You never know what's going to happen. Especially in the things we don't have control over.
It's honest. That's the one thing I can say about this show.
Well,
I mean,
I thought it was nice that that Bill Kohar let his kid Zach just jump on the board without knowing where he was going with it. It was sort of an improvisational moment. That's a good dad. It just says, "Go ahead, kid. You know, we're trying to run a radio show here, but you know, just push a button, see what happens." That was nice, and you did a great job.
Hope he's union.
You know, you mentioned something in that eternal bit you just did, which was, I'm trying to remember.
That was half as long as one of your diatribes about whatever the hell you talk about.
Oh,
well, I'm looking on the internet.
Okay, Riley. Look, I...
Hi!
Come on, man. Come on, dude. People read sometimes and people talk. I've done my share of looking on the internet when we've been doing the show, but Greg Barrett is the transition I was looking for. You mentioned he's just not that into you. Greg Barrett was in New Orleans when I was in New Orleans. Greg Barrett, of course, is a friend of Jim and I's, a comic from way back who wrote that book.
Right.
And he's also a comic. He's got a show in development. He's going to be the next Oprah.
Oh, yeah.
He was apparently doing the celebrity poker thing.
Really?
That's another thing I neglected to mention about New Orleans, is that I should not go into casinos. It's just stupid. I don't have fun. I'm not lucky. I should, if I'm going to go into a casino, I should just take $300 out of the ATM and throw it on the floor. That would be, or not. I don't know what the hell's wrong with me. It's not that I'm unlucky, Jim, but I, for some reason, believe I can win when I sit down at a blackjack table.
I just can't count, so that's my problem.
And I had that weird moment where I've had this moment before. You know, we were playing blackjack and like the dealer's got 16 and I've got like a 17 and I'm like, yeah, hit me. And then the person next to you goes, what the hell's wrong with you? You're screwing up my cards. And then you look at him and go, I'm gambling. Apparently you have some sort of sickness. I'm living on the edge here. I'm looking for the buzz, man, the rush. But needless to say, I lost $300.
Did you get a rush? A buzz?
No, I won two hands out of like 20. I lost $300. And I've talked about this on the show before, man. I've talked about that I learned my lesson with this, but if there is a casino around, I will go in. And you know what? I'm helping the city of New Orleans. Can I rationalize it like that?
Sure.
All right. We'll be back in a second.
Live from Burbank, California, founded by aliens from outer space, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now do not be afraid. He doesn't want to hurt you. Mark Maron.
Oh, man. Oh, damn. Thanks for that intro there, Jim. I appreciate all the help.
You know, I work hard.
I know you do, man.
For the money.
Hey, so in a little while, we're going to be talking to Brian Nelson, the writer and producer of a demonic, psychotic thriller based on predatory activity on the internet, based on a guy, a young guy who courts over the internet a 14-year-old girl and what happens. But it's very compelling and it's grisly. So we're going to talk to him in a little while. Also, I want to talk a little bit about our leaky president. I'd like to talk a little bit about that because, you know, the bottom line is it seems to me that this guy can just say whatever the hell he wants about what he does, and as long as he commits to it, there's about 31% of this bordering on moronic country that is still going to support him, and I find that disturbing. We'll get to that in a minute. We're on the phone right now with a guy who's going to, you know, help do something about it. Stephen Elliott is the author of the political memoir Looking Forward to It, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the American Electoral Process. He's also a founder and executive director of LitPAC, a political action committee which seeks to get authors more involved in the political process through readings, fundraising, and open support of progressive candidates. Welcome to the show, Stephen Elliott. How are you?
Hey, Mark. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm great.
I'm glad you're here, man. And I guess I need to start off right off the bat. How did you stop worrying and learn to love the American electoral process? I don't want to ruin the book for people, but please help me out.
You know, politics is just such a... The thing about politics is you just got to be involved.
Right.
You know, and really... Ultimately, you know, it's like it's the only game for adults.
Yeah,
you know, and it matters, and it's so even though it's heartbreaking half the time, you know, especially in 2004, it's particularly heartbreaking. You know, once you pick yourself back up and you get back into it, you always feel pretty fulfilled, to be honest.
I'm trying to be fulfilled, but I find that in ramming my head up against this administration's propaganda, that I'm more likely to get more frustrated. And right when I think I got an edge on it, something else happens that they spin in a certain direction. But they're losing their ability to do that successfully, which makes me happy.
Yeah, it's impossible to argue with you in these points. You know what I mean? We're on the same page.
Okay, so what about how do you address the rigged elections? I mean, are you of the belief that that 2000, 2004 were either rigged or stolen?
I'm certainly of that belief. In 2000, you know, the book, looking forward to it, is a campaign trail book about the 2004 election, and I spent the whole year traveling with George Bush and John Kerry and Howard Dean and writing about that experience. I'm not sold on the belief that the 2004 election was stolen, but I'm not sold on the belief that it wasn't. There's obviously some really incredibly shady things that happened in Florida in 2000.
Oh, yeah, definitely in Florida. But a lot of people believe Ohio was the culprit in the 2004.
There's a lot of evidence to support that.
There's still people waiting online. Stephen, there's still people online today waiting to vote in Ohio.
Yeah, I know. It was a mess. And, you know, we had this Operation Ohio going in 2004. We brought all these authors to Ohio, and we did these voter registration readings. And I heard back from a lot of people about what went down. It was just awful.
Yeah, we talked to a lot of people as well. I guess in terms of electoral politics and learning how to love it, I think the consensus is that since the beginning of time, or certainly since the beginning of elections, that elections have been rigged one way or the other. There's been some sort of malfeasance or whatever the word is.
I'm from Chicago. You know, we take pride in these things.
Yeah. So and it's also of my belief that if it is, you know, unquestionably a landslide. As if we could somehow mobilize the American public to get away from this 50-50, 45-55 schism between this evenly split electorate, then maybe we'll be able to overwhelm any sort of rigging.
Well, yeah, there's certainly that. You know, what we're trying to do with LitPAC, mm-hmm. we're trying to raise funds for progressive congressional candidates who are running for House seats.
Now, explain to my listeners what LitPAC is.
You know, LitPAC, it started out in San Francisco. I was organizing these readings, and I would get these great authors to come and do these literary events. You know, Daniel Handler, who is also known as Lemony Snicket,
mm-hmm.
sold 48 million books. Tobias Wolff, Dave Eggers, Anthony Swafford, the author of Jarhead, James Smiley, all these great literary authors. I get them together because, I'm an author. I've written 4 novels. I know the other local authors. We'd all get together. We'd do these readings. And we'd raise $2,000 or $3,000 at each reading. And these readings are just authors reading from their work. It's a really good time. It takes place in this bar. We have one night in the makeout room. It was just going so well. I thought, hey, let's start doing one of these in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And things just kind of took off. Jonathan Franzen got involved. Rick Moody got involved. And so we decided, well, let's just do it all over the country. And at that point, we had to form a political action committee.
Wow, so now I got an idea. It's probably crossed your mind, call me stupid, but it seems to me that out of those authors that you just mentioned, if you just get them to give you like a nickel a book, that you'd be all set.
Well, that's true, but it's not so simple. You know, the FEC has a lot of laws about raising funds, and there's ways you can do it and ways you can't do it, which is why, you know, what we want to do is we want to do several things. We want to raise $75,000 that we're going to give to 15 progressive congressional candidates in $5,000 each. We also want to take groups of authors like Daniel Handler, Lemony Snicket, and these guys into competitive districts and do voter registration readings, like we've been invited to do that in New Mexico by Patsy Madrid, who's mm-hmm. running against Heather Wilson in New Mexico. We also want to go with these authors on their tours when they have large turnouts, better-known authors, and register voters at the readings. And finally, we're going to offer, in certain districts, we're going to offer voters a chance to receive a reminder phone call from their favorite author on Election Day reminding them to vote.
Wow, so Jonathan Franzen will call somebody up and
right.
say, get out. He'll say better than me, probably, like, well-phrased.
The great thing is that you'll get a, you know, people are always willing to call you on election day, but here's you're getting a phone call from somebody you might actually want to get a phone call from.
Yeah, or else you might get like men answering the phone yelling, "Who the hell is Rick Moody?"
Yeah, that's right.
Why is Rick Moody calling?
You pick the author. You know, you get to decide. You know, if you live in a district that's been targeted.
Is Rick Moody involved?
Yeah, he's in fact on the board of advisors. So he's heavily involved. So Daniel Handler's on the board of advisors. So is Amy Bender, Los Angeles author, and also Daniel Handler. Daniel Handler, Rick Moody, Amy Bender, and Tobias Wolff.
All right, well, let me ask you a couple questions first about literary culture in relation to politics. It seems in my recollection, and I'm just speaking as just a guy. We're not talking about – we'll get back to the lit pack in a second. It seems to me that when I was growing up, my recollection when I was a kid in the 70s, that literary figures were like rock stars, and that in this media culture that we live in now, it seems that they've been, you know, somewhat marginalized to the literary demographic. Like, I remember, like, people like Mailer and George Plimpton and other authors constantly appearing on talk shows, being animated, being part of the political dialogue. Do you think that our generation of writers has not as involved in politics unless you ask them to be?
Well, I think the thing I realized about authors, you know, and I realized this when I started putting together anthologies to fundraise, is that first off, authors are they're all liberal. They're all political. And that's because to be a good author of literary fiction, you have to have empathy. And if you have empathy, you're a liberal. you know, and if you think about the world in realistic terms, and you analyze it, you're going to be a liberal.
If you're empathetic for the right reasons.
You know, I tell you what, I searched high and low to find a conservative author that would to contribute a story to my anthology of political fiction, and I could not find any conservative authors. Finally, after it came out and I started saying on radio, hey, there's no conservative authors, they're all liberals, people started saying, no, Mark Halperin's a conservative.
They got one guy.
One guy. also the same guy.
Yeah.
Six or seven times.
That's
one
hilarious.
Author out of all of literary fiction. That's pretty much, when it's only one author.
Yeah.
It's negligible. You can pretty much say all authors are liberal because when the exception is only one author, it's such a negligible percentage that you don't even have to count it. So
right.
First off, all authors are liberal.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. And maybe it's because there was a certain tone among some authors in the 70s that I think a lot of times writers are a little socially awkward. That's why they write. So maybe they don't allow themselves to be sucked into the limelight as much.
Right. But if you give them an opportunity to be political, they will almost certainly take it. And that's what we're trying to do. I mean, Lit Pack, it's not going to be Move On.
Right.
And it's not going to be George Soros.
Right.
But it's about taking a segment of the population and making the best use of it that can be used for, you know, good political ends.
I think that's great. And I think it might elevate a literary culture a little bit in the minds of the voters and also get people who, like writers who are very intelligent and culturally sensitive to engage with people they might not engage with otherwise.
I think that's absolutely right.
And yeah, where can we get the Lit Pack? Where can we go? Litpack.org or .com?
It's litpack.org. It'll give you all the information on the organization. We have a schedule there of upcoming readings. Right now we've got them in San Francisco and in New York. We have them scheduled now. We're going to start doing monthly readings in Boston.
Okay.
We're going to do a reading in Los Angeles.
Great.
In June.
Well,
and we're also organizing readings in Chicago in July and in Seattle.
Awesome. So I'll send people to the site on our site. And also, if you could tell Rick Moody to give me a call, even if it's not election thing, I'd just like to talk to him about the ice storm a little bit.
Okay. I'll let him know.
All right. Thanks a lot, Stephen Elliott. You take care of yourself.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
You bet, man. So when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the leaky White House and maybe a little bit about what I ate in New Orleans and Brian Nelson. Brian Wilson will not be here. Brian Nelson, the writer and producer of the film Hard Candy, will, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now he always answers with the simplest of truisms. Mark Maron.
That's interesting, Jim. See, again, I'm responding to your silly intros of me, and I should just, like you're provoking conversation somehow, but you're just, you're just trying to get by.
No, man.
Yeah, you're just trying to get through this.
There's meaning in everything I say.
Oh, my God. My brain is full of this book. This guy's going to be on our show. If everything works out correctly, by the way, you're listening to the Mark Maron Show. I am him, and that's my buddy Jim Earle.
Hi.
On the second mic. On the fiddle. Hey, look, this guy, Kevin Phillips, who I think has been making the rounds pretty well, who wrote American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. This book is mind-blowing, brain-bending. It answers all those questions that we've been noodling over for the last 3 years or 4 years or even the last 100 years in terms of the politics of oil, in terms of its assessment of religious movements in this country, in terms of what and how the Republican strategy switched around to accommodate all this stuff and how they're going to do it no matter what. It almost seems that these, and we've already assumed this, that this particular administration and this group of the neocon death cult with Bush at the head or with anybody at the head is determined to grab hold of whatever remaining oil reserves there are on the planet and use the American military as a police force to protect them and capture those spigots in turn and try to stop. And I know Randy's been talking about this a lot. Try to stop any of that oil money being moved through either euros or Chinese currency, because that would completely destabilize the American economy as if it's not there already. The biggest debt we've ever had. But in light of that, you have what is clear to everybody, almost everybody, except people that have a mental problem, a delusionary problem that has to do with deep Republicanism. Not old school fiscal Republicans, but some sort of the Christo-fascist zombie brigade style Republicans who refuse to acknowledge or see that the Iraq war was based on lies. And that's been proven. The reason I talk about this is in light of these leaks in terms of whether Bush was the top dog in the conspiracy, which it seems it was a conspiracy that was put forth out of the White House to leak information, intelligence information that was started in the CIA, that started the National Intelligence Estimate. That what is clear is that Libby, trying to save his own butt, which he's not going to be able to do, they are going to send him upstream. They're going to send him to the big house for this. He's going to take the rap on this, is that it seems that Libby, trying to save his own butt in talking about Cheney and Bush both, being the source of these leaks of classified intelligence, that the first response of the liberals and the Democrats was like, ha, there we go. We solved it. Here's the smoking gun. George Bush is guilty. He's guilty of treason. Let's impeach him. And believe me, there are people that all over the country that are ready to impeach this guy. I'm ready to impeach this guy. And this might be an impeachable offense, but not because he necessarily leaked information, which he says that he is allowed to do, but that the information that he is allowed to do it. But the information that he did leak, he was not allowed to do it. And in his defense today, he said, quote, I thought it was more important for people to get a better sense of what I was saying in my speeches, and I felt I could do so without jeopardizing ongoing intelligence matters, end quote. He knew very well that the intelligence that he was leaking was crap. He knew it because he forced the CIA, he coerced and bullied the CIA to give him manipulated information that was based on crap. And then here's another quote. Quote, so I wanted people to see the truth. And I thought it made sense for people to see the truth, end quote. That's the president. The truth, this guy is committing to stuff that is crap, to information that everybody in the country knows is crap, except for the 31% of the people, 30 to 35% of the people, that refuse to see Bush as anything but a leader, the president, and someone who's honest. This is a delusionary sector of the population that will go with this guy anywhere as long as he commits to it, as long as he says, we're sticking by this. These people will stick by him. And that's 31%. That's a fairly big number in relation to how many people vote. So that 31% is lost to us. But the other 25% or 21%, anything that'll tip it over 50%, are available to us. Bush is losing independents. He's losing some evangelicals. He's losing, a lot of fiscal conservatives. But this 31% that he's talking to here, we're never going to get to. And the bottom line is that it was illegal what he did. Apparently, he can't just declassify information because he wants to, according to Executive Order 12356. He can only declassify information that starts in the White House. It starts in his branch. If it starts somewhere else, it has to go through a review process. And this information started at the CIA. So in that sense, he broke the law and I think is guilty of, what is it, treason? I wish I knew the charge. Espionage?
No. I would think that's treasonable.
All right, that's treasonable. Yeah. We'll be back in a second with somebody from the film Hard Candy.
Now he does a job most Americans are unwilling to do. Mark Maron.
Yes. Thank you, Jim. See, I'm not going to address the comment. Thank you. Nice to see you, Jim.
Yes.
You're listening to the Mark Maron Show.
Very topical comment.
Tremendous, man. It's good to see you. I missed you when I was in New Orleans eating the good food. Folks, the film Hard Candy. Man, this is a good one. Deals with the difficult topic of internet predators. The story revolves around an internet predator's process and relationship with a 14-year-old girl. The way the film depicts the events that unfold during that type of demonic courting is graphic, disturbing, and the outcome of the relationship is more graphic and disturbing, grisly even, in a way that you couldn't even begin to expect. The film got a great response at the Sundance Festival this year, and it's going to open in select cities on the 14th of this month and nationwide on the 25th. The director of the film, David Slade, is with us. How are you, David?
I'm doing fine, thank you very much. We're getting ready for the premiere tonight.
Oh, it's tonight?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, that's exciting. Now, let me just ask you, in terms of the response you've been getting to this film, this is a very shocking, provocative, and mind-blowing movie. Now, what has been the response? Have people, what has been, have they been horrified? Have they been excited? What?
Well, you know, one of the things about the film is you know, you speak in these terms of the grisly and shocking, and, you know, a hell of a lot of it is off-screen, and a hell of a lot of it is alluded to.
Uh-huh.
And as a result of that, actually, you know, getting in our writing was very simple, very easy. And the core of our film's text, and there are many subtexts,
yes,
is responsibility.
Okay.
And, you know, I was just interviewed by a journalist recently who said it was good, responsible filmmaking. So, you know, those words kind of tend to play towards sensationalism. And the film, I hope and believe, from Brian Nelson, who's a playwright, is incredibly astute and smart script, to the fantastic performances of Patrick Wilson and Ellen Page, the two lead characters.
So now let me
hopefully deflect a lot of that kind of gristle that you talk about, and just really engage the viewer on a human level.
Well, that's what's interesting.
Yeah,
is
right.
that you know, you have a playwright, the guy who wrote it, Brian Nelson, and produced the film, and you directed it. Now I'm assuming that he, in developing this character, in order to make him real, what's very shocking about the movie is this is a guy. He's a successful guy. He's in his early 30s. He looks like somebody I might know. He doesn't fit the standard.
The myth that we have and that we have in our minds when we think comfortably about these people now.
And the fact that, you know, you had to not make him a sympathetic character, but at least round him off to make him understandable on a human level, it must have been sort of daunting to audiences.
Indeed, yes, and it is. And one of those things is that people are used to seeing films which neatly tie everything up in a bow and explain away, and some does not. And it does not for a specific reason, and this comes to the, you know, from the first time I read the screenplay, is it asks questions of the audience, and that's, I think, a rare and important thing these days.
What are some of those questions? Could you share them?
Yeah, you know, sure. I mean, it, you know, on a broad strokes, where do you draw the line? You know, would be the very easy and simple one.
In terms of
what's acceptable and what isn't when it comes to everything from a relationship, the age range, the what you call vigilantism and what you don't, what you call acceptable pornography, what you call, not acceptable pornography, not that we show pornography in the film. It is not that kind of film.
So you're dealing with the moral struggle of the protagonist, this guy, this photographer who is courting this 14-year-old, in terms of how he rationalizes it, how he puts it into perspective himself, how he...
Indeed, and the, you know, that character, you know, Patrick Wilson, the actor, who's a wonderful human being, and should never be confused with the character he's playing. You know, he took the stance of being honest and believing he was innocent. And, you know, that really is a shocker when you actually go through this film, because here you are watching a film involving, you know, one of the most heinous monsters we have in society, and yet there's Patrick, and he's not what you expect.
So this is
and it just, you know, that was the important thing to us, because, you know, these people are the kinds of people who have the charisma and the vocabulary to get close to people, and this was very important that we not play to stereotypes, but we try and be as naturalistic as humanly possible.
So in that sense, there was a sympathetic element in terms of characterizing this guy as a human being with a problem that he has justified in his own mind. And the weird thing about this, David Swade, is that this predatory issue, this idea of people, you know, just doing this constantly is constant. It's always in the news now. You've got a member.
Yeah, you know, we shot this in 2004 when it wasn't. But let me just go back to that, what that statement you just made, and it really, which suggests that we take a side as filmmakers, which we do not. I mean, Ellen, you know, the page who plays Hayley Stark is a 14-year-old who preaches constantly. This does not mean as filmmakers we are preaching her point of view, nor do we take the stance that Patrick is a damaged human. We throw these characters to you, and the degree to which you bring in your own frame of reference, it kind of becomes like a Rorschach test for you. You know, you kind of take away what you brought into the film. Not to say that we're eluding the issue. You know, to me, this is a film principally about responsibility, about how complex, you know, these actions are, be they watching pornography, chatting on the internet, and how much responsibility they should really involve as a responsible adult.
Right.
And how we as a Western audience just don't like responsibility.
Right. We're talking to David Swade, who's the director of the new film Hard Candy, which premieres tonight here in Los Angeles, but will be opening Select Theaters on the 14th and nationwide on the 25th. What's that?
It's actually the 28th, I believe.
Oh, 28th of this month. Okay. Well, you know, I just, for people who are just tuning in, the film is about a young professional guy, a photographer, who engages on the internet with this 14-year-old girl and sets up a meeting, and what, you know, what happens after that. And as you were saying, you did the film.
Spoilers, yeah.
I'm not going to spoil the end. What you said is that you did this in 2004, but it seems to me, and I believe it to be true, that there is somewhat of an epidemic of this type of behavior, because the internet almost facilitates it. It becomes a delivery system for these
people. The internet certainly something that becomes like a membrane you can hide behind, and it's certainly something that has become more prolific as that membrane has become more prevalent in society and more accessible, for sure.
And certainly there's a lot of law enforcement dedicated to cracking down on this. Now, I guess what I want to ask you about the film, in the process of making it, what were some of the obstacles that you and the writer sort of came upon in terms of what you wouldn't do, or what you thought that, you know, how you sort of eased this character along in a narrative fashion so it was believable? What were some of the things that you chose not to do?
We chose not to be graphic. I mean, in the sense of, you know, there's a difference between visceral and viscous. And you know, visceral to me is about, you see something, it hits you in the chest, mm-hmm. and then the reaction is where you make the human connection afterwards.
Right.
And viscous is just that gore, that blood that you see in horror movies. It's not a horror movie. It's actually a polemic. I mean, if I could describe what it was, then it would make marketing a lot easier.
Right.
But, you know, the challenges were, you know, to tell the story in a way that was responsible. You know, using that word again.
Yeah, responsible in this.
And, you know, to be, first of all, in casting. To cast Ellen Page, who was 17 when we shot the film, who is incredibly articulate, incredibly smart individual, who, you know, is going to get through this film intact.
He's
not going to get disturbed by this film. And to work on set at all times in a way that is conducive to being correct and being proper and being safe.
Because so,
there are a lot of kind of action moments in the movie that had to be supervised. And we had a, you know, we made this film, to put it in context, we made this film in 18 and a half days for under $1 million.
Good for you.
And it's in that kind of a run and gun situation, safety becomes a big issue that you've got to be very careful of. You know, one of the things we did was actually, you know, the exteriors of our house that we, you know, take place, we actually shot at the stunt coordinator's house, because what safer place to do stunts?
That's interesting, because sort of ironically, that's how they shoot porn.
Yes, yeah. But please don't make that connection.
No, I'm not going to make that connection at all. But what I find engaging about what you're saying is that when you keep saying the word responsibility, what you're saying is that you have two extraordinary, you know, two extremes here. Both can be sort of morally questionable. And what you have with that is, from that equation and from your choice not to be graphic in the sense of being gratuitous, is that people will be confronted with their own morality around this issue.
Exactly right.
You know,
and this is what happened when I read the screenplay.
Because, well,
if you are of a persuasion to want the character who is, let's say, without being using a sword, or the Punisher, then okay, let's play that out.
Yeah.
And see how messy that really is.
Right.
You know, because you might start to change your mind.
But and if you were the character of the pedophile, oddly, you know, that knowing that this Punisher is out there, you might want to think twice about that. So there's a responsibility issue there as well.
Indeed, yeah, and you know, I mean, I can't comment upon the wider
implications
of the film, but certainly, you know, there is a certain psychosis to both characters.
Right. Well, you know,
it's the issue.
I appreciate you being with us, David, and I really hope people see this film because it's incredibly compelling. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. Man, it is a heavy movie, and morality, bam, in your face, as Emeril would say. Did I just say bam? See, New Orleans, I still got it. We'll be back in a second with the Short Order News.
Stay tuned for 3 minutes of crap. That's right, Mark Maron's Short Order News is coming up next.
And now, the bitch is back, Mark Maron.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah,
Jim, what? Did you just call me a bitch?
Man, I called you a bitch in a good way, though.
Oh, thanks, buddy. Do you have your guitar out for a reason? Would you like me to introduce you?
Sure,
please, man. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome the guitar stylings of Jim Earl. Singing involved here?
Mark.
Yeah?
That's it.
Oh, man. Come on.
That's it.
You actually wrote that one. That wasn't a take on another song.
No. I wrote that one, man.
Man, that's really creative, man. Thanks for doing that.
Hey, no problem.
Hey, I never got to what I ate in New Orleans. Are you interested at all?
Probably something with a face and two mommies and a
I think in
daddy.
During one meal, I broke every rule possible to break by a vegetarian. I did the most wrong type of eating.
No beans and rice, though? They got great beans and rice. I had some great pasta there when I was there.
Dude, I can't believe... should I fess up? Man, I feel like this is a liberal confessional, but there's no way that anyone will forgive me for what I ate in New Orleans. We went to this restaurant. I ate a baby. No, I'm kidding.
That's okay. I'm all right with that.
Is that wrong?
No.
I mean, they did it with a nice sauce down there, and they told me it's like a Cajun recipe, and, you know, everybody does it. You know, I don't know. It was okay. It tastes like chicken.
Yeah.
Anyways,
don't eat the rattle.
Look, here's what I ate. I'll be honest with you. And not that this is that interesting. I did want to talk about the fact that young Army officers, including growing numbers of captains, are leaving. There's this new trend in the Army where people are leaving after their first tour, right when they can. Enlisted officers are leaving. They're not staying.
Yeah, well, this whole war thing ain't working out.
Yeah, that apparently is the issue. But never has it been like this before. It's surprising even the Pentagon. And the reason is, I think, is ultimately, if this is any indication about the American response and about the response of the American people to a war that was based on lies and is now, you know, being fueled by just stubbornness and the desire to protect oil reserves, then the Democrats have got to start talking in terms of, you know, not just national security, but in terms of just they've got the majority of the people who are understanding this. But the weird thing about this is, and I don't know why I just started talking about this, because I don't have time to really flesh it out, is there's going to be plenty of people that believe that taking over those resources and guaranteeing oil for America for the next 20 years, we're past peak oil in most places, is worthwhile. That, you know, why shouldn't America do that? We need to worry about the future in terms of fuel. Whereas, like, why not start putting together some alternative energy resources and looking towards that avenue? But there are some people in this country that are willing to let Americans die to protect oil and the future of America's car consumption society. But look, let me tell you what I ate. Boy, I shouldn't have even gone in that thing. That was such a big, deep issue, and I'm just blowing it off, and I'm going to talk. All right, so course one. All right, but all I'm saying is the military, the people in the military have been waking up for the last couple of years, and they're even waking up.
Well, they were
now
lied to get, you know, recruits.
Exactly.
I mean, just like the American people were lied to about the war.
Exactly. So,
So
three plates come first. Okay, there's a scallop in one plate, some mussels in another plate, and then some tortellinis. All right, that was just an appetizer. Right, then they bring this series of several different appetizers, frog legs. All right, never had them before. Took one bite of them, not for me. Not, you could taste a reptile, and I had a problem. My conscience wouldn't allow me to eat the frog legs, all right? So I didn't eat that. I just had a taste.
Well, sure, they had a lot left over, you know.
Foie gras? How bad is that? How evil is foie gras?
It's horrible.
I know, and I ate it, Jim. I ate it, all right? And then you want to...
What are you, Louis the 14th?
You want to know what the main course was, dude? Pork belly. Not just a pork chop. Pork belly. I ate the belly of the pork. All right?
Yeah.
I feel bad, man.
Man, it's disgraceful.
Foie gras and pork belly. What the? Someone ought to just hit me. Will you hit me?
Sure.
Good improvisation. Hey, folks, look, a lot happened. I'll save it for the confessional. A lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure you don't get caught off guard or uninformed. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. Computer drives containing U.S. military secrets are being stolen from an American base in Afghanistan and sold by thieves at a nearby bazaar. Afghan workers at the base have also been stealing watches, refrigerators, and packets of Viagra, and military experts worry openly about what a terrorist might do with a four-hour erection. A screaming bearded man was arrested on the White House grounds while the president was at home, reacting to the charges, and angry Al Gore said he was nowhere near the place. Just like the Wallace and Gromit film, a monster rabbit has apparently been rampaging through vegetable patches in a small village in northern England and infuriating local gardeners. The most infuriating thing for local Englanders was being reminded what vegetables were. Huh?
They don't eat a lot of vegetables.
I got to eat vegetables. That's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Short Order News. Now, can I finish about this food?
It's going to take you like 50 psyllium husk jars to get that pork belly and that, muscles out of your lower colon.
I was in New Orleans. You're supposed to eat that stuff, man. I mean, pork belly was a little weird.
They have great pasta and rice and beans there, too.
I ate that, too. I wasn't stopped. I wasn't deterred from eating rice and beans and jambalaya.
What'd you have on the weekend, like a warm monkey brain?
Yeah. That was the other thing. They had tripe. They had tripe, Jim. I mean, look at what the hell happened to me? What is wrong with me? I ate a goose liver, a force-fed goose liver. I ate I don't even know what tripe is.
It's tripe is like, you know, what's inside your... Isn't that stomach?
It's disgusting. I feel guilty.
Rocky Mountain oysters? You should have made a left turn into Texas.
No, I didn't eat Rocky. You know, some of it was tasty, but I got to be honest with you. You should go to New Orleans and enjoy the cuisine. But, man, this was gluttonous, and it was disgusting, and I think I need to get off the meat altogether. But I don't think I'm going to get it's no rallying call. I don't think people are going to support my vegetarianism anymore. They don't believe in me anymore. I tried, but I failed. And after this weekend in New Orleans.
You should do it to stop global warming. Then they'll be on you.
All right. All right. Yeah. All right. Can we call Lori David?
Yeah, let's call her up again, because I got questions.
She never called us back, and I felt bad about it. You know? Why'd I have to alienate Lori David?
I just ask her a question. She should, you know.
No, I'd like her to address it. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Look, tomorrow we've got Mike Lyons from Band of Brothers. That's a Veterans for a Secure America. We got Terry Zwigoff, the director of Crumb and a couple other films. He's going to talk about his new movie that I'm going to watch this evening. So come back, will you, and listen to me and Jim tomorrow. Good night, sheeple.